I'd like to start by thanking the organisers for giving me the opportunity to present this work here today. What I want to talk about is sort of two slightly decoupled recent developments in these theories. The first part is based on actually the Polmer reduction of strings on ADSN with no additional sphere space, and this is based on some unpublished work with Akali. And the second part is based on this is about this Q deformation of the ADS5 cross S5 superstring, and this is based on this paper with Tim Hollowood and Luis Miramontes. So I want to start by just giving a brief overview of the Polmer reduction, mainly in words. As far as I'm concerned, what I'm interested in is as a classical reformulation of superstring theory on ADS5 cross S5 and its various subspaces. So the key features of this reduction are, firstly, it solves the Virasoro constraints of the theory, and so it only describes the physical degrees of freedom, preserves classical integrability, preserves 2D Lorentz invariance, which is kind of its most attractive feature, and it's also, when we consider the superstring theories, it's UV finite. The kinetic terms for the fermions turn out to be sort of standard kinetic terms, and this is sort of indicating some hidden two-dimensional supersymmetry. Finally, these are a special class of some UV finite massive integral models that were really discovered through this Polmer reduction procedure, and they deserve some study regardless of any quantum equivalence with the original superstring model. So a little bit of history to start with. The Polmer reduction, as it was originally formulated in 1976 by Polmer, relates the ON sigma model to some integral Hamiltonian systems. Particularly, the O3 sigma model is classically related to Stein-Gordon, the O4 to complex Stein-Gordon, and this actually led to the discovery of integrability in these ON sigma models. And then there was a series of works in the late 70s using the techniques of classical integrability to study these theories. Polmer reduction sort of has played a role in string theory as well. First of all, you can always interpret the ON sigma model as describing a particular gauge fixing of strings moving on an N-1 sphere. But that wasn't actually the first time it was used in string theory. The first time it was used was back in 1981 and 83, where these authors sort of modified it slightly to deal with the de Sitter and anti-de Sitter spaces, and they used it to construct some classical string solutions in these constant curvature backgrounds. There was then a bit of a lull for the 90s, late 80s and 90s, and then it received a bit of a resurgence with the ADS-CFT correspondence, when it was used to construct classical string solutions representing semi-classical closed string states in the ADS-CFT correspondence. And then even more recently than that, it's been used in the study of Euclidean open string weld surfaces and 3- and 4-point correlation functions. So, to get to the Polmer reduction of the ADS-5 cross S5 superstring, this is the route at which the logic goes. We start with the original Polmer reduction, which is relating classical strings on a 2-sphere to Stein-Gordon or 3-sphere to complex Stein-Gordon. We then understand these as symmetric coset spaces, F over G. We can generalize the formalism in a group theoretic manner, and basically we find the classical strings on the symmetric space F over G are related to the G over H gauge Wessamino-Witten theory plus an integrable potential. And this actual class of models have been known for a while. They're known as the symmetric space Stein-Gordon models. And then we can go even further, go to the full type 2B superstring theory on ADS5 cross S5, and we can get the Polmer reduction of the ADS5 cross S5 superstring, and this is given by it's given by the Polmer reduction of ADS5 cross S1 and the Polmer reduction of R cross S5, and this is sort of two decoupled models based on the gauge Wessamino-Witten model for this coset and this coset, each with its own integral potential, and then they're mixed through some fermions. And the key points about this model are, firstly, as I already mentioned, it's UV finite. The one-loop partition function agrees with string theory. There's actually a discrepancy in the two-loop result, but there is a very suggestive relationship that it would be, well, at the moment it's not understood, but it would be obviously nice to understand. The Polmer reduced theory has some classical soliton solutions, and the conjectured S matrix for these solitons is actually given by the strong coupling limit of the quantum deformed light cone gauge fixed string S matrix, and this will be the subject of the second half of my talk. But in the first half of the talk, I want to sort of really address something related to this final point, which is that this construction is really only suitable for classical string solutions which are non-trivial in both ADS5 and S5. So it would be nice if we could extend this construction to consider strings only living on ADSN. And in particular, well, the actual Pommer reduction is known, but we would like to find an action for this set of equations of motion.
Sorry, I thought that we already disagreed that one loop was some solution.
So one loop partition function agrees. Agrees. Two loop doesn't. What? Oh, you thought it already disagrees at one loop, did you say? Like what? No, I don't know. Okay, no. Right. So this is what we want to do. We want to find an action formulation for the Pommer reduction of strings on ADSN. In particular, we want to explore the connection with the Pommer reduction of strings moving on ADSN cross S1. And then we'd like to check some fluctuation frequencies for simple classical solutions and compare with the corresponding string theory results. Why do we want to study this theory? Well, this is the Pommer reduction that was used extensively in the study of open string well surfaces and three four-point correlation functions. And maybe the construction of the action and inclusion of fermions may allow these computations to be somehow generalized or extended. So I'm going to start with a review of the coordinate-based Pommer reduction, which gives us a set of equations of motion that we want to find from an action. So to do this, we consider ADSN embedded in R n-1, 2 in the usual way with some embedding coordinates, y mu, where this index mu is contracted with this mixed signature metric. And then we can write the world sheet action as follows. We have the world sheet metric. We have the world sheet metric of usual kinetic term. And then we have a Lagrange multiplier imposing the ADSN constraint. And if we vary this action, we find this constraint, and we find also the Virasoro constraints and the equation of motion for y. Now, if we consider the three vectors y, d plus y, a, and d minus y, they span a vector space, and if you restrict the inner product to this space, it has signature minus, minus, plus. And everything I say will be assuming a time-like world sheet here. You can generalize everything I say for a space-like world sheet, and it should follow through. So this means that we can find n minus two vectors, ni, which are orthogonal to these three, and have the following inner product, strictly positive definite. We then define the fields phi, ui, vi, and b plus minus ij in terms of this y and these n's as follows. I mean, the only one to point out really is this phi sort of parameterizes the difference between d plus y and d minus y. And then you can use these string equations of motion to compute a set of equations of motion, an equivalent set of classical equations of motion, for this set of fields. And they're given by this. So what do we have here? We have some modified Seitz-Gordon equation. If we set ui vi to 1, we just have Seitz-Gordon, so it's just deformed by this factor. And then we have these vectors ui and vi have when the covariant derivative, or d minus, where d now is covariant, acts on u is 0, and d plus acting on v is 0. And then we have the field strength for b being constrained in terms of u and v. So some features of this equation is the motion. Well, it has an SON minus 2 gauge symmetry, under which b transforms as a gauge field and u transforms as a vector. If we substitute n equals 2, we find a conformal theory, we find Liouville theory, which is conformal. And actually, we can extend this whole system of equations is still conformal under this set of transformations here. So it's this set of equations that we would like to find an action for. Okay, so what's our plan to do this? We start by regulating this reduction procedure by introducing an extra S1. And we give this a coordinate theta, and we gauge fix this coordinate equal to mu tau. The Pommer reduction of strings on ADSN cross S1 is then well known and has some action formulations, so we can go ahead and do this. We have to modify this reductions procedure by introducing some asymmetric gauging, which depends on this function mu, in such a way that when we take mu to zero, we're left with some non-trivial string living on ADSN. So, here we go. We start off by writing ADSN as a symmetric coset space now, as F over G, and label the algebras as follows, and then we can decompose F into G plus its orthogonal complements, which we denote P. We then introduce group-valued field F in the corresponding left-invariant Mara-Cartan 1 form. And then this is an algebra-valued object that we can decompose under this structure here into a piece P and a connection A. The world sheet taxon for strings on ADSM cross S1 is then simply given by the symmetric case coset sigma model plus the kinetic term for this extra S1 direction. Now, in the reduction procedure, the starting point is to fix conformal gauge and also this S1 angle proportional to the world sheet time. So we can go ahead and compute the equations of motion, and they're given as follows. We have basically d plus p minus and d minus p plus both equal to zero. We have d mu p mu equal to zero. We also have the Virasoro constraints, and here essentially we've picked up this mu squared on the right hand side. This is precisely because we've introduced this extra S1, and eventually when we want to take mu to zero, this is going to give us the Virasoro constraints for ADSN as expected. Finally, we have these are first set of first order differential equations. We need to supplement by some additional first order equations, and this is just given by the flatness of the Mara-Cartan 1 form. And this is an algebra valued equation, so we can decompose under P plus G. So we start by trying to solve the Virasoro constraints. So the standard route, as it was originally formulated, was to pick some maximal abelian subalgebra of P. This is a one-dimensional algebra, and we pick it such that it's generated by some element T, such that the trace of T squared is negative. One can then fairly easily see it's possible to use the SON-1 or the G gauge symmetry to write P plus proportional to this element T and P minus equal to mu times G inverse T G. And here it's fairly easy to see that once we're using this relation, once we substitute these into here, the Virasoro constraints will be satisfied. And then I just want to comment that we can use T to pick out a subalgebra of G by taking it as the subalgebra which commutes with T, and this, in this case, turns out to be SON-1. And then we can go ahead and decompose G into this algebra plus its orthogonal complement M. Now, the point here is that if we take mu to zero in these equations, we're just left with zero. So it gives us some trivial string solution. So we need to modify this procedure somehow. And what we do is we still need T, but we also consider some other element, and this time it's an element of M. Now, just to remember, M was this orthogonal complement of H in G. And this element we denote R, and you pretty much have, you have to take trace R squared equal to 2, and then when you commute T with R, you pick up another element in P, which we denote S, and this also satisfies trace of S squared equals 2. Now we can play the same game again, and we can denote the subalgebra of H that commutes with R as K, and we can, which in this case turns out to be SON-2, and then we can denote the orthogonal complement of K in H as L. So essentially what we've done, just to summarize, we've sort of got this cascade of algebras sitting here. We start off with F equals SON-1, 2, decompose into G plus P, pick out an element of P which we call T. This identifies a subalgebra of G known as H. We can then decompose G into H plus M, pick out an element of M, which we denote R. This picks out a subalgebra of H, and we can decompose H under K plus L. So, to actually modify how we solve the Virasoro constraints, we introduce the following algebra automorphisms, which are just given by these expressions here. Now, when I write mu to the plus or minus r, what I mean is e to the ar log mu. And from this you can see for finite mu, this is a perfectly acceptable algebra automorphism. It's not going to do anything funny. We go ahead for finite mu and we solve the Virasoro constraints by writing p plus equals to mu epsilon minus of t and p minus equals this expression. And you can see that because of the trace in the Virasoro constraints, essentially it knows nothing about this algebra automorphism. They just sort of cancel under the cyclicity, and this will still satisfy the Virasoro constraints. However, the key point here now is this has a non-trivial mu goes to zero limit. When you take mu goes to zero of P plus, you find actually some T minus, non-zero element T minus, and when you take mu goes to zero of P minus, you find G inverse T plus of G. And here T plus and T minus are some linear combinations of these algebra elements T and S, such that, and as required, they trace, when you square them, they trace to zero. So again, they're clearly going to solve the Virasoro constraints when mu is equal to zero. So, We also need to solve the equations of motion. And for this, we keep mu finite for now. And then it's fairly easy to see that the equations of motion can be solved by introducing two new fields, A plus and A minus, which are living in this algebra H. And remember, H commuted with T. So that we can just, if we take epsilon minus acting on A minus, it will commute with epsilon minus of T. And so you can just parameterize A minus this way and A plus this way. And these will solve this pair of equations. So we can substitute all of this into the equation, the remaining equation which we haven't solved, which is the flatness equation projected onto G. And this gives us the equation of motion for the reduced theory, which looks like this. And what we see is we have some asymmetrically gauged Westermeier-Witten equation, sitting up here, and plus some potential. So the first thing we want to do is we want to take the mu goes to zero limit. We then want to gauge fix to find some Lagrangian set of equations. So to take the mu goes to zero limit, we've already discussed basically these potential terms. We know that mu times epsilon plus of t and mu times epsilon minus t have some finite non-zero limit. The only other place that mu appears is in these gauge pieces, epsilon plus of A plus and epsilon minus of A minus. And so just to briefly discuss those, to deal with these, we need to decompose A plus and A minus under this decomposition K plus L. So because by construction K commuted with R, essentially the algebra automorphism will act trivially on it. The mu to the R will just go straight through. Now, C tilde of plus and minus we need to be a bit more careful with. Essentially, we need to rescale by mu, and then we find that when we take mu goes to zero, we get some new field containing the same degrees of freedom as C tilde plus and minus, but living in some different space in the algebra. And they live in these spaces L plus and L minus. And these L plus and L minus are essentially defined by acting with epsilon plus and minus on L and taking mu to zero. With appropriate rescalings. But there are some key features of this L plus and L minus, which mean we've done something rather non-trivial. First of all, they commute with T plus and T minus, which is useful, but not so important. But the most important is that L plus and L minus are abelian algebras individually. L plus commutes with L plus and L minus commutes with L minus. And they transform as vectors of SOA minus 2 under the adjoint action of K. And actually what this means is that K plus L plus minus contain generators of two copies of the Euclidean group EN minus 2 with some common SON minus 2, subalgebra or subgroup. And essentially what we've done in a rather convoluted way is we've performed a contraction of the algebra SON minus 1 to EN minus 2. So we can then go ahead and partially gauge fix, and what we can do is we have this gauge symmetry, Euclidean group EN minus 2 right cross EN minus 2 left, and we can gauge fix C plus minus equal to 0. We're then left with some SOA minus 2 cross SOA minus 2 gauge symmetry, which we can partially gauge fix to leave a single copy, and the resulting set of equations come from this action here. And what do we have? We have essentially a gauge Westermeier-Witten action for G over K where SOM minus 1 comma 1 over SOM minus 2 plus some potential. And our claim is that this action gives the required equations of motion. So we can see this explicitly, and to do this we just need to parameterize G in this following way. So we start off by introducing a group valued element in this group K, which is SOM minus 2, and then to fill out the rest of the group we have some exponential of some algebra element living in L plus, some exponential element of some field with R, and then an exponential of an algebra element living in L minus. And if we substitute this into this action here, and we do some expansions and blah blah blah, we end up with this action here. And here we have a Liouville action for phi. We have a gauge Westermeier-Witten action for K over K, and these two actions are mixed through these terms involving psi plus and psi minus. And the reason this action takes such a simple form essentially is because these psi plus and psi minus live in abelian algebras. So we can go ahead and compute the equations of motion for this action, and we find the following following set. Now, for now I'm not going to worry about this set, but this one I want to just point out. It has the form of D plus and minus acting on something equals zero. And this, if we remember back to this coordinate-based reduction we started with, is very suggestive. Actually, what it tells us what it suggests that we should do is define U and V as these somethings in the brackets, and then if we eliminate K as well by taking, well, either D minus of this equation or D plus of this equation and using these bottom two equations, we end up with this set of equations. And here what do we have? Well, we have a modified Seitz-Gordon equation. If we set this to 1, we would have Seitz-Gordon. This is some deformation. And then we have a covariant derivative of V equals covariant derivative of U equal to 0. And then we also have the gauge, the field strength for B constrained in terms of some anti-symmetric combination of U and V. And it's fairly easy to see that when you expand this out in terms of components, we'll find exactly the same set of equations we found earlier as from the coordinate-based reduction. So to conclude this half of the talk, We found an action formulation for the Polmer reduced string on ADSN. In particular, we've done it in such a way that we've connected it to the Polmer reduction of strings moving on ADSN cross S1 through this mu goes to zero limit. And just to emphasize what we're claiming this action should be, it's this one. We have Liouville plus gauge Westmuller-Witten for K over K mixed through some terms involving Xi plus and Xi minus. So, I'm not going to describe it today, but this limiting procedure can be extended to the full superstring. If you start with a Polmer reduction of strings on ADS 5 cross S5, where you assume the string has some non-trivial part living in both sectors, and what you get is some action for the Polmer reduced ADS 5 cross S5 superstring for classical solutions which only live in ADS 5. Now, fluctuation, you can go ahead and compute fluctuation frequencies, and particularly we did it for a classical solution which corresponds to the large spin limit of the GKP string. And these agree with those from string theory. In particular, we find all 8 plus 8. And then you may ask, well, does this give us some possible matching of the one-loop partition function? And this leads me on to some open questions which I want to finish this section with. In particular, in this fluctuation computation, we find some extra massless modes. And these extra massless modes essentially come from the presence of having psi plus and psi minus in the action rather than U and V. If you count degrees of freedom of this action, you really want to consider U and V as your fundamental fields. But if you try and put U and V into, substitute for U and V into this action, essentially you'll just end up with some integral over UV, which is not particularly useful. We won't give the required equations a motion. Now, everything I did was with a time-like world sheet, and actually this leads to an action if you do compute this fluctuation frequency, if you compute the perturbative action around this classical solution, actually leads to an action with some ghost-like kinetic terms. Obviously this doesn't affect the frequencies, but if you want to start talking about one-loop partition functions, quantum theories, then you need to really sort of ask, why are they there? How is this resolved? Can we make sense of this? And finally, for the space-like, what's particularly nice is if we go to the space-like world sheet, we have to wick rotate K to SO1, M minus 1, and actually what you find is that you get the correct sign for all the kinetic terms. So maybe this is suggesting that the space-like world sheets are actually the correct setting to think about this theory, and maybe it can be applied to some more complicated string solutions, open strings, etc. So that's the end of that half of the talk, and I just want to stop if there are any questions for that piece. Nope. So then I'll move on. I'll move on to the cuneiformed Lycone gauge fixed superstring. So why are we interested in this theory? Well, first of all, what do we want to do? We want to study the Q deformation of the Lycone gauge fixed superstring R matrix, and solve crossing and to find the phase and the overall S matrix.
In all the applications which were discussed for solutions, for classical solutions in ADS, the world sheet was actually
for in the discussion of say minimal surfaces ending on contours on the boundary of ADS, or for minimal surfaces for three-point functions, the world sheets were actually Euclidean.
So actually this second point ties in with what actually most of the research has been done on so far, this space-like world sheet, Euclidean world sheets. So we'd like to study this quantum deformation of the light code gauge fixed superstring. If we take Q, how does this link in with the Polmeyer reduction? Well, if we take Q, the deformation parameter, to be a phase, in particular of this form, in the strong coupling limit, we actually find the conjectured R matrix underlying the scattering of solitons in the Polmeyer reduced theory. Here I just want to mention a very important open question, which I'm not going to sort of say anything about, but I need to mention it, which is regarding unitarity of this this quantum deformed R matrix, S matrix. Basically, it's not matrix unitary. It's not physically unitary. It also doesn't match with the perturbative result. However, the perturbative result doesn't satisfy the Yang-Baxter equation. So there's some tension here, and we're not, at the moment, there's no sort of, as far as I'm aware, no sort of good way of resolving this. But I have nothing more to say on that issue today. However, if you go ahead and you believe the conjecture, what it does is it provides some quantum connection between the Polmeyer reduced and Lycoen gauge fixed superstrings. And in some sense, this is some quantum analog to the idea of a classical interpolating Poisson structure. And here there may be some connections with the recent generalization of the Fedorov-Reshetkin procedure to the superstring, which Mark will talk about later today. And finally, a motivation for studying this theory, other than providing this quantum connection between the two theories, is that if you study the TBA for this interpolating theory, this deformation parameter Q, especially when it's a root of unity, does provide some regularization. There was a very nice paper earlier this week where they studied this, and Stein will talk about it later on. When your K is a bound state, when K is an integer, basically it truncates the spectrum. And so, anyway, I defer to Stein to talk about that. It's not what I know about. So, he will talk about that later this afternoon. So where do we want to start one? We want to start from the algebra of the light cone gauge fixed superstring, which is PSU22 squared with three central extensions. And for now, we'll just consider one factor. We have two SU2 algebras. We have some fermionic generators, which are charged under these SU2s. And we have three central extensions, which appear in the anti-commutation relations of these supersymmetry generators. To quantum deform, we should go to a Cheverly basis with some Cartan subalgebra and some raising and lowering operators and introduce some serial relations, and then modify the defining relations through the introduction of a new parameter, Q. And this quantum deformation was first done in 2008, and Alessandro briefly described it on Wednesday. So what we're interested in, really, is scattering of two particles, and for this we need the R matrix and the action of symmetry on two particle states, and for this we introduce the coproduct. For generators in the Cheverly basis, the coproduct takes this form. And then for consistency of the coproduct with the product, in the quantum deform theory, star 1 and star 2 should be some non-trivial multiplicative combinations of these generators. Essentially what we have here, well, these group-like elements. Essentially what we have here is we have the identity. We have Q to the power of the Cartan subalgebra. And we also have an additional braiding factor U, which is the same as from Lycoen gauge fixed string theory, and it's related to the world sheet's momentum. We have three central elements. They should have they're central, so they should have a trivial coproduct. In particular, we define V to be equal to Q to the C, and then P and K are constrained in terms of U and V in this way, with a new coupling G being introduced. So, a brief mention about couplings. The theory we're discussing therefore has sort of two couplings, G and Q. For now, we will consider, well, we're considering Q to be a phase, and then in this situation, when we take G to infinity, K becomes the coupling in the Polmer reduced theory, and as K goes to infinity, G is proportional to the string tension. We get back to the light co-engaged fixed superstring. It's actually also useful to consider this very nice redefinition of couplings to G tilde and Xi, introduced by these authors. They had their own reasons for introducing it, but I just want to briefly sort of explain why it's nice from this Polmer reduced theory perspective. Well, essentially we've ended up, the end game of this discussion is to try and construct some interpolating S matrix, where when we take G goes to infinity, we get to the Polmer reduced theory. When we take K goes to infinity, we end up with the light co-engaged fixed string. Now, if we look at how these couplings Xi and G tilde behave, well, essentially Xi behaves like some angle coordinate in this picture and sort of moves you from one theory to another in this way. And then G tilde plays the role of the coupling in both theories. And so maybe this is a wild sort of hope, but if you could find some physical quantities which were independent of Xi, then you could map them between the two theories and you could get some information from here over to here. It's maybe a possibility. Right, so as I said, we're interested in scattering. What are we interested in scattering? We're interested in scattering single particle states. So single particle states are modules corresponding to the 4×4 dimensional representation of this quantum deformed algebra. And notice here that I've reintroduced both PSU22s. And so this first index on this state, it corresponds to the first PSU2, and the second index corresponds to the second PSU2. And both indices run from 1 to 4. The quantum deformation, right, so if you have this 4×4 representation, basically for the closure of the algebra, you require the central elements to satisfy some shortening condition. And the quantum deformation modifies this shortening condition in the following way. So we just introduce some quantum numbers for C and a half here. And if we recall that CP and K can be written in terms of U and V, then we find that substituting this relation into this shortening condition, we find a constraint equation for U and V. And eventually, what we'd like to think of particles being labeled by U and V, although I'll change this in a minute, but at the moment we'd like to think of particles being labeled by U and V, satisfying this constraint equation, which will eventually become the dispersion relation. We can also introduce the sort of, to connect with the standard sort of literature, we can introduce the variables x plus and x minus in the following way, and this satisfies this constraint equation, and what's nice about this is when we take q goes to 1, this right-hand side becomes I over g, and we're left with the usual light co-engaged fixed string representation. So it's completely equivalent to, instead of labeling states by u and v, to label states by x plus and x minus instead. So the R matrix then maps from the tensor product of two modules with different spectral parameters to, well, the normal R matrix maps to the same space. Here I've acted with the permutation operator to invert the spaces, because I have. Here VXI is the 4×4 dimensional module spanned by this basis of states phi AA dot. The R matrix is then completely fixed by the symmetry up to a phase, and this was first done by these authors in 2008. One can then actually extend this quantum deformed symmetry that I've been discussing so far to an infinite dimensional quantum deformed affine symmetry, and that was done in 2011 by these authors on the top, and this fixes the bound state R matrices again up to a phase, and this was done by these authors at the bottom. So the S matrices should then be given by these R matrices with the phases fixed by unitarity, crossing, and fusion. So the Q-deformed S matrix story was quite a long story, many, many papers. Luckily for us, the Q-deformed S matrix phase construction follows a very similar logic, and rather than 20 papers, we can use all the ideas and bring them together and it can just be done in a single paper. Essentially, the solution of the crossing equation takes the following form. Here, this is the sort of sigma here is the phase of the S matrix. We write it in terms of these functions chi, and then there's an associated Riemann-Hilbert problem that can be solved, and then chi can be written in terms of these contour integrals over this log of gamma, Q-deformed gamma functions. The Q-deformed gamma functions are defined in this way. And then what's particularly nice is that when you take Q goes to 1, these Q-deformed gamma functions become usual gamma functions, and then, for those of you who know it, this will quite obviously return to the original light cone gauge fixed string phase expression. Now, you can also take the limit G goes to infinity, and in this case, you can show that the phase reduces, you can also show the phase reduces the correct relativistic expression. So this is good. However, there's some very strange feature which appears in this theory, which is the following. So I just want to introduce a bit of extra notation at the moment. Here, elementary particles are sitting in the fundamental representation of this, PSU22 squared. And this fundamental representation we denote by these angle brackets, 0, 0. And this squared just refers to the two copies. And we can decompose this under SU2 to the 4 in the following way. Now, in the string limit, it's well known that the bound states transform in the representations 1, 0 squared, which decompose under SU2 to the 4 in the following way. However, in the Polmer reduced limit, if you just take the G goes to infinity limit of this phase and you study it, and you look where the poles are sitting on the physical strip, you find that the bound states actually transform in the representation 0, 1 squared. So something rather odd is going on here. From the perspective of the two individual theories, it's actually completely fine. In both the light cone gauge fixed, basically, in both theories, the bound states should be associated to the SU2 squared that comes from the sphere sector of the theory. So both theories have a sphere sector, light cone gauge fixed string theory, obviously. Polmer reduced theory, essentially, it's the reduction of the sphere. Now, in the two limits, this is completely innocuous. If we forget about the middle theory, we can just associate a different pair of SU2s to this SU4 of the sphere. And algebraically, this is completely fine. The associated modules are completely isomorphic, including fermion number. And this is all because we've actually got this squared sitting here that this works out. But what happens as we move between the two theories? Well, to answer this question, we're going to have to go to the dispersion relation. So this was the constraint equation for x plus and x minus, which eventually we want to turn into the dispersion relation. And it's consistent with the usual light cone gauge fixed string reality condition, which is given by x plus minus star equals x minus plus. And if you go back to the definitions of x plus and x minus, you find that this is equivalent to demanding that U and V are both phases. And so what we can do is we can introduce momentum and energy in the following way. And these rescalings by various couplings are done just so I get the correct limits out in a minute. But if we substitute these in to the constraint equation for U and V, we find this rather weird dispersion relation, which I put a caveat here. I'm not really sure what the full physical interpretation, especially the periodic nature of the energy sitting here. But anyway, you can take the limit K goes to infinity, and you indeed find the usual Magnon dispersion relation. You can also take the limit G goes to infinity, and you find a nice relativistic expression, which is actually the dispersion relation for the Polmer reduced theory. So to introduce the situation for bound states, essentially we can just add some A's in certain places. When A is 1, we have the elementary excitation, and for higher bound states, A is just an integer running upwards. And then to answer this question about this switch of the bound state nature as we move through the coupling space, we try to solve this equation here. Firstly, let me just say, we look for solutions when either x1 plus equals x2 minus or x1 minus equals x2 plus. Essentially, this is because this is where the poles of the R matrix... Well, this is where the two-particle state representation stands a chance of... can decompose into... These are the points in the R matrix where you can find... find bound states, essentially. And here, each of these, this is a fusion diagram. Each of these three sets of energy and momentum should satisfy their respective dispersion relation. So here we have two fundamental particles. So these should satisfy this equation when A equals 1. And they come in and they fuse and they should, then this outcome should satisfy this relation when A equals 2. And this gives us some non-trivial equation, and I should emphasize that E1 and E2, P1 and P2 should all be real, and you also have some restrictions on the signs of R and S. Some physical restrictions. And you can just run along these lines and you can scan through and look for all different solutions, and what you find is the following. You find that you have two branches of solutions. Essentially, when P is less than A pi G over K, then the bound states form in this 0, A squared representation. And when P is bigger than A pi G over K, the bound states form in this A, 0 representation. And what's particularly nice about this is that we see that as G goes to infinity and we go to the Polymer-reduced theory, essentially this top line is always satisfied and this bottom line is never satisfied. And so we always get the bound states forming in the 0, A representation. And as K goes to infinity, it's vice versa. This top line is never satisfied, and the bottom line is always satisfied, and the bound states form in the A, 0 representation. And there's a rather special point at P equals Xi E, and this is then equal to A pi G over K. And at this point, the bound states become marginally unstable. So I just want to finish off, actually, with a little picture. So this is, again, coupling space. Here we have 1 over G, and here we have 1 over K. So over here we have the Lightcone gauge fixed superstring sitting. Here we have the Polymer-reduced superstring. And then for fixed momentum, essentially we have this line over which, in this sector, the bound states form in the A, 0 squared representation, and here the bound states form in the 0, A squared representation. And then you can do the whole exercise for the mirror theory as well. And what you find is the bound states always form in the 0, A squared representations. And this is particularly nice because it's well known that for the light cone gauge fixed string S matrix and the mirror light cone gauge fixed superstring, the bound states form in opposite representations. However, we know that the Polymer reduced superstring is Lorentz invariant, and therefore the bound states should form, under the double wick rotation that you need to get to the mirror theory, the theory is completely invariant, and therefore the bound states should form in the same representation. So this structure here actually provides us with a mechanism to make all this consistent, which is very nice. So to conclude, the quantum deformed superstring S matrix and its mirror have been constructed. Provides us with some quantum connection between the light cone gauge fixed and Polymer-reduced superstrings. And then I just want to briefly mention again that one of the motivations for studying this theory is to look at the TBA. I used to have this in open questions. I had to, bump it up to recent development. And Stein will be talking about that later today. And finally, to just finish with some open questions, ones that I've mentioned already about the matrix unitarity of this quantum deformed S matrix and perturbative Q deformed, and the relationship between the perturbative and the Q deformed S matrices are kind of important. But at the moment we have no real ideas of how to deal with that. It would be interesting to study in more detail what the relation of this S matrix story to the semi-classical partition function is. And finally, some more forward-looking questions. What about other limits of this interpolating S matrix, double scalings of G and K? And also, there's some interesting questions about the G goes to infinity limit of this underlying quantum affine symmetry. And finally, to finish off, sort of a very important question, maybe. It would be nice if there was some physical meaning to this interpolating theory. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So it was 5 minutes fast, actually. So we have lots of time for questions.
Could you maybe comment a little bit more on what happens when the momentum has the critical value for which the ground states become marginally unstable, as you said? What are the implications of that?
Essentially no bound states can form at this value of momentum. You just get a string of single particle states sort of, they don't actually fuse. The energy of the multiparticle bound state, if you like, is equal to the sum of the energies, so it's not really fused into a new state. It's just sort of a string of single particle states sort of sitting together.
I have some questions. What have you already tried in terms of finding this interpolating theory, if it exists, or
any particular
recoupling? Have you thought about what it might?
G goes to zero.
Yeah.
Well, G goes to zero is some very strange. Well, up here you actually find, if you look at the algebra, you find GL2/2, a quantum deformation of GL2/2. In terms of recoupling, I don't know of any real developments. In Marish's papers, and you discuss G goes to zero limits of the bound state S matrix, but the only thing I do have to say is that in terms of this structure of bound state structure here, remember I said here different set of SU2s would have to be associated to the S4 sector, the sphere sectors of both theories, and this means that somehow if you were to construct some geometrical sigma model interpolating between the two theories, it would have to somehow flip the compactness of the spaces.
What happens when you, maybe this will be answered later today, but when you look at Konishi and you just switch on a little bit the Q deformation, what?
I don't know. Are you going to talk about this later today? Oh, Stein? I don't know where he is. You're not going to talk about it later today? I haven't thought about that for TBA at all, like, really.
Since we almost know Konishi to six loops now, just so
I'm running a little bit
okay.
behind.
So
So the comment about mirror theory is basically that it's a TBA which is the right framework to work
in the mirror theory. Yeah.
Connect this theory. So at the level of say asymptotic Bethe-Ansatz, which is based on this matrix, there is some tension, so you wouldn't be. That makes sense because if we say solve this sigma model, Polmeyer reduced sigma model, it presumably is solved in terms of TBA with no spin chain, maybe in mind, and it's not clear which gauge theory would be dual to it.
Oh yeah, no, there's no string interpretation of anywhere.
Okay, any further questions? So then, as I said, please don't run away. We will thank the staff, and in particular the conference secretary. But and we are really on schedule, so we will, as planned, come back in the usual, I guess, 10 to 11. But before that, let's thank Ben for the nice talk again.
Okay, so I hope you are enjoying this nice conference so far, and I hope you've enjoyed it and you're still enjoying it. And to me as an organizer, it was a pretty smooth conference. I didn't have to interfere too much during the conference, and not least this is certainly due to the efforts of Denise, who I would like to see now. she walks in. So so Denise has taken care of many practical issues behind the scenes, and I'm sure she's interacted with many of you before the conference and helped you out during the conference. And yeah, that helped us very much. And she's also made some very practical suggestions for the conference. For example, the conference dinner location was her idea, and I think you all enjoyed that. So for me, the organizing was also a pretty pleasant organizing in our team, and especially with Denise. So I would like to thank her, and I hope you will join me in thanking her.